What I'd like to do tonight is to divide it up into several parts. First, I would like to share with you the story, because it seems that people are interested in the story. Second, I would like to try to explain what I learned from the experience that I had. And third, I'd like to say something about the political situation in Israel, which I know that all of us here are very concerned about and very intensely involved with. I would also like to, before I start, to say that one of the lessons that I learned was that it really makes a difference that people daven and say Tehillim. You should not think ever that this is an idle matter. Okay. So I'll tell you the story. All of you have been to Israel, so you know that today the way you connect from Efrat to Yerushalayim is by going through tunnels. These are not the biggest tunnels that have ever been built in the world, but for us in Israel, they're pretty exciting. Little tunnels, but nice little tunnels. These little tunnels are built as tunnels because it was hard to get from point A to point B, from Gush Etzion to Yerushalayim, without going through some Arab village. So the great idea was, we'll go under it. And that's what we do. We go from Gush Etzion to Yerushalayim under an Arab village. Now, while these tunnels were built, and this is also part of the story, it's a little geography, and I know that information is always annoying, but I'll do it anyway. Right, so there's what's called the old road, the old route. The old route is called Walaja. Walaja is the name of the back part of Beit Lechem or Beit Jala, where the very fancy Arabs live. And we used to go through Walaja, down a winding road, and end up in Gilo. This was not such a great option, but until the tunnels were finished, that's how we did it. That's how we did it. Before that, for those of you who remember back to Intifada number one, we used to drive through Beit Lechem to go from Yerushalayim to Gush Etzion, and we used to drive back and forth past an Arab refugee camp. And they would throw stones at us, driving by, approximately every day. I mean, I say approximately because there may have been a day where they didn't throw stones. But it felt like it was every day. I remember years ago I was driving with a well-known Rosh Yeshiva in the direction of Gush Etzion, and suddenly the roof of my car literally caved in. That was not, usually they threw, I don't know how they did that, because what we did, they built a fence, a very high fence. You had to lob the stones over the fence, but somehow this stone was about 20 kilo of stone. And so the Rosh Yeshiva said to me, in the way of Rosh Yeshiva, he said, "What was that?" The Rosh Yeshiva don't always want to admit that they know what's going on, right? So I said, "Nothing." And the truth is that for those of us who made that trip back and forth every day, that was really the way we did it. What was that? Nothing. No, it just kept going. So after the route through Beit Lechem was cancelled, we went through Walaja. After the route through Walaja was cancelled, we went through the tunnels. When this intifada started, It started about a week before my encounter with the Palestinian police. And on that day of Thursday, the Israeli army had started using a new tactic, which was to shoot. In the past, they sort of just shot back generally. You know, like general, I don't know how many of you have been in the army, but there's something, it's like general shooting, where you just, they point you in a direction, you close your eyes, and you shoot generally, right? This is supposed to make the other side nervous, right? Because, I mean, you shoot real bullets, but you're not shooting at anybody in particular. Unfortunately, they apparently seem to figure this out, and this made them bold. So the Israeli army's response at this time was to train snipers. It was a very interesting idea, who would shoot at real targets. And that day, on that Thursday afternoon, was the first time that the snipers had been employed, and two Arabs who were throwing firebombs near the tunnels were killed. And this caused a ruckus. And because of this ruckus, the tunnels were closed. But let me go back a minute. I finished teaching in the yeshiva at Prophet 6 o'clock, Thursday before Yom HaKippurim. Thursday before Shabbos, Yom HaKippurim is on Monday. I finished teaching at 6 o'clock. I have to get to Yerushalayim. I felt, I felt I had to get to Yerushalayim. There was somebody sitting shiva who was going back to America that night, and I thought it was very important that I should be able to get to visit them. So I was in a hurry. You know that's like a life problem. You know, sometimes you think you're in a hurry, and you then make decisions based on the fact that you're in a hurry, which you shouldn't make. You shouldn't be in a hurry. Like, there was no reason, but I thought I was in a hurry. So at 6:30, I got to the tunnels. When I got to the tunnels, the army had closed the tunnels. They closed it because they could not protect the people coming out on the other side. The other side of the first tunnel, there are two tunnels, a long one and a short one. In between the two tunnels, there's a bridge. On that bridge is exactly in between the guys in Beit Jala who shoot and the people in Gilo who get shot at. In other words, when they shoot from Beit Jala to Gilo, they shoot over the heads of the people in the cars that are going on the tunnel. Naturally, everybody understands that it doesn't take that much of an effort to instead of shooting like this, to shoot like this, right? So the army closes the tunnels. You can't go that way. So we were all in a hurry, everybody who was there, so we went up through the old road to Walaja. Walaja, the same problem. They closed that road also. So there we are, like a convoy of cars, unable, we couldn't go this way, we couldn't go that way. The only reasonable option then is to go through Beit Shemesh. Beit Shemesh, from there to my house or to Yerushalayim takes an hour and a quarter instead of a half an hour. You understand how people think about things. And all of a sudden, everybody's time is very, very precious. You know, how could I invest another 45 minutes of my life to get to the same place I get to in a half hour every other day? So we all U-turn, like a convoy of cars U-turn. And then I'm watching, I see I'm behind. It was getting dark. It was about 6:30. It was almost dark. And I see that I'm in back of taxis. Now these taxis were Israeli taxis. There's a difference between Arab taxis and Israeli taxis. Anybody who's been there knows that difference exists. So I saw Israeli taxis. This is where I made a very serious mistake, right? It's hard to admit mistakes, but I did. I followed these taxis, which were Israeli taxis. Unfortunately, it didn't occur to me at the time that Arab taxis from East Jerusalem look exactly like Israeli taxis. Exactly like. They're the same. The only difference is that the person who's driving them is an Arab instead of an Israeli. I followed these taxis into Beit Jala on a road that led to the old road to Beit Lechem, which would then get me into Yerushalayim. Now this was theoretically a legitimate thing to do, but not something that you should do, right? You shouldn't do it. And the reason that I did it was because I thought I was following Israeli taxis in a convoy. As we went into Beit Jala, there was a convoy. I mean, there were 10 cars, 12 cars. We were going down a narrow road, and I was stopped the convoy was stopped. And then two Arab policemen came and stood at my car and told me to get out. I realized that this was not, you know, like, they didn't look friendly. I mean, how could I say it, you know? I mean, I don't mean that, you know, I mean, some people think that there aren't any Arabs who look friendly, but these two guys look particularly unfriendly. So then I thought that I could, I just discovered a good use of my electric windows. So I closed all my windows, I called my wife on the telephone, and I said to her, well, I didn't know what I should say. You know, it was a difficult situation. And I say, I think they're going to kill me. I didn't think that that was like such a good idea. So I said, Miriam, I don't think I'm going to make it on time. Because I was supposed to meet her at this shiva. So I said, I don't think I'm going to make it on time. She said, what happened? So I said, I think I'm in trouble. And then I hung up. Then I hung up. And there's like another story, as a story that, if you ever come to Yerushalayim, you can ask Miriam her story, which is much more interesting than my story, actually. Because my story is about incompetence, and her story is about competence. But that's a story for another occasion. You can invite her. These two Arab policemen started, screaming at me that I've got to get out of the car. And so I closed the windows, and I didn't get out of the car. But then they took their rifles. They had these assault rifles, these Kalashnikovs. Policemen in England, policemen have notepads. That's their weapon, like a ballpoint pen, they click it in, and then they're policemen. These policemen had AK-47 Kalashnikov assault rifles, right? That's what they had, which is like, if you go to Afghanistan, that's what you take along with you, right? But these are police. These particular rifles had wooden handles, and they started smashing away the windshield of my car. So I thought to myself at the moment that staying in the car might not be of a special advantage to me. So I got out. And then, of course, since I'm Jewish, with 3,000 years of Talmudic learning behind me, I decided to talk to them. This was obviously not a great idea, because their response was to, what they did was they grabbed me and they pushed me against the wall, pushed me down. All this is not so interesting. But what is interesting is they then called the mob. I mean, I don't know, they have this mob lying around just waiting for something to do, and they called. I would imagine, it was hard for me to tell, but that there were at least 15 and maybe 20 young hoodlum type people, not wearing uniforms and not dressed in special kind of clothing, and they with the two Arab policemen standing there, sort of standing guard, I don't know who they were guarding exactly, proceeded to give me a pretty good beating. I say a pretty good beating, not because I have a good comparative beating knowledge. The truth is, no one ever beat me before. I grew up in Brooklyn, and we were always running away from those big kids in the schoolyard. I don't know if you know about that, but in Brooklyn, there's schoolyards, and there are big kids in the schoolyards. And at Shabbos, it was always a problem going to shul, because you couldn't go the short way, you had to go the long way. But this was something that I'd never experienced. These guys, they did it mostly kicking, mostly with their feet. There was one guy had a stick, and they gave me a very good beating. I don't think I was conscious all the time, and the beating must have gone on for at least 10 to 15 minutes, at which time a Palestinian police vehicle showed up, and two guys got out. These guys obviously more honorable than the first two guys I had met. These guys wore sweaters. Sweaters is more honorable. You have to be an officer to get a sweater. So both of them had sweaters. They grabbed me. I couldn't really walk. They put me into the jeep, this police jeep and they took me to the what is now the police station in Beit Lachem, in Bethlehem, which was then, in when I remember, Intifada number one, was the military authority of Israel. Right, that was our building. We used it, and then we gave it to them. Then the building is built. There's a building, there's a courtyard, there's a wall around the courtyard. It's kind of a fortress. It's built like a fortress. They took me into the courtyard. In the courtyard, there were all kinds of people. I don't know what any of them were doing there, but not dressed as policemen, dressed as civilians. And there I got another beating by people who were there. Right? Oh, another group. These two guys with the sweaters also stood by and let the beating go on for as long as it went on. I think I lost consciousness at that time. And then they took me, they grabbed me. These two guys, I couldn't walk anymore. They dragged me into the building. People ask me, what were you thinking? It's like a question that a lot of people ask. And I'll tell you the truth, I was, in retrospect, grateful for the pain. You know, pain is a very engulfing kind of feeling. It's very hard to escape it. It's very hard to overwhelm the pain with thinking. And the pain prevented me, actually, from thinking too much about how bad my situation really was. So they took me into the infirmary. The infirmary was a room that had nothing in it, nothing that could be called equipment. You know, neither tables, nor chairs, nothing. But then there were a few guys who said they were doctors. And that was the first time that they told me that they were going to eventually release me. And they explained that they were righteous, and because they were righteous, they were going to release me. And had this happened in the other way, right, the other way where the Israelis would have caught some Arab, they would surely have killed him. I want to remind you that this was Thursday afternoon before Yom HaKippurim, exactly 1 week later, Thursday afternoon in Ramallah, right, two Israelis were brutally murdered as part of a story that was very similar to the story that happened to me. It was just that a week earlier, there was still some control that they had on their own people. A week later, they'd lost that control as well. So they told me that was the first time. One of the doctors, or someone who said he was a doctor, took some alcohol with a little cotton swab and tried to clean up the blood so I wouldn't look so bad when they gave me back. Well, there was so much blood covering so much of me that he kind of just gave up and he wasn't interested. They put me in a cell and kept me there for about 2 hours. During those 2 hours, various Arabs came in to tell me the story again, how they're good people and they're releasing me, and that had this happened to an Arab, he would be killed. It was like a recorded message that went over and over again. Finally, they, at about 10:30 at night, they had agreed that they would return me to the DCO, which is a joint, which was, today these things don't really exist anymore, but there was a joint authority, a kind of an office, where the Arab police and the Israeli army would be able to talk to each other. So they were in a building, one door in the building was Palestinian, the other door was Israeli, so they brought me into the Palestinian side and handed me over to the officer in charge. An interesting sidelight there, a curiosity. Before they handed me over, I went to the office of someone who was obviously a very high-ranking Palestinian official, who gave me my briefcase, which was in the back of my car, and told me that they had found $400 in my briefcase, which is true. I mean, this is perfectly legal. Don't get nervous. Will not be called upon to testify. And he said to me, "We're returning the $400 to you." So I was like a little groggy, and I didn't understand what this whole show was about. why he would say that and why he did it. But afterwards, when I got onto the Israeli side, I remembered that I had a large amount of shkalim. I never have any money. It's just not my style. Don't have any money. But it was Erev Yom Kippur, and I had a lot of money that I had to give out at Stokin. I had a lot of cash that I had to give up, and they for some reason, they stole the shkalim, which is a very large amount of money, and they gave me back the $400, which either says something about the strength of the shekel, the dollar, or... But Zerem Zachbarim, you know what I mean? They took the trouble to tell me that not only were they morally and ethically significant, but they were also not criminals, little crooks. They were going to return this money to me. But apparently the big crook didn't know that the little crooks had already stolen the money that I had before they gave back the dollar. So then I was in the DCO. There was a doctor. They brought in a doctor right away who helped me out, and then they got me out of there. Now they got me out of there. I know Rabbi Robinson told me that he's collecting money. His shul is raising money. I was collecting money. His shul is raising money for an arm and ambulance for Big Tav. I went. They took me. They had to take me through the tunnels. They had to take me through the tunnels to get to the Hadassah Hospital, but the tunnels were closed by the army. Right, the army. Here was the army. Had to deal with itself. You know, how do I get a little problem? How they get me through the tunnels when they themselves realize that you can't go through the tunnels? And what would happen if they take me after saving me from Beit Lechem? How do you get shocked in the tunnels? That would be ridiculous. So they got this armored ambulance, an Israeli army armored ambulance. They took me in this armored ambulance, and they brought me to the Hadassah Hospital. The interesting thing was, you know, the people who were in the armored ambulance, the paramedics and the nurses, very, very serious. They're very serious Israelis. They're very serious Israelis because I guess it's a big cover to work in the armored ambulance, you know, instead of like the regular ambulance. So the armored ambulance, if you shoot it, nothing happens. If you shoot at it, nothing happens. It's armored. It's all made out of steel. But it can only go about 20 kilometers an hour because it weighs like 10,000 kilos. And they don't change the engine. The engine is the same old engine that they had in the regular ambulance. So it's like chugging along, you know, chug, about 20 kilos. So I was lying there on this stretcher and looking at all these serious people. So I said to the paramedic, I said, you know, it's true that if they shoot us, nothing's going to happen. But what if they have a bomb and they put it under the truck? Then we're finished because you'll just roll over the bridge. So they got nervous. I figured I was all right. You know, I had been saved. I mean, why should I get nervous about it? But in any event, I got to the hospital. The hospital, I have only good things to say about the medicine in Israel, which may be a sign of like mental problems that I have, but I always felt that I was treated very well, and that the kind of care I got was exemplary, and that will more or less bring me to the second part of my story. The second part of my story was that I spent about 2 weeks in orthopedics. I don't know how many of you doctors, and I hope none of you are in orthopedics. Is there some reason? Who's like does orthopedics? No, Baruch Hashem. Orthopedics, you know, orthopedics are like a strange breed in Israel, at least where I was. You know, orthopedics, you see, in a lot of wards in the hospital, people are sick. You know, like one of the reasons you go to hospitals is because you're sick. Now, being sick is kind of like puts you in a weakened state. You can't talk, you can't argue, you can't fight with anybody, you know. But in orthopedics, they have a lot of people with subrochon abeina. You know, like a lot of people have broken bones, or that, like their backs are in the wrong place, or that this is missing, or that's missing. But in other ways, they're very healthy. So the orthopedic ward is full of people who are annoyed. They're like annoyed all the time. And they're screaming all the time. And it's just like a terrible place to be. So I was in this ward, I was in the ward. I was sick. I thought I was sick. I didn't know I was doing in orthopedics. I mean, it's okay to get swollen. But everybody around me was like healthy as a horse and yelling all the time and screaming at me and saying, you know, come on, do this, or what are you? Or what? It was terrible. And then suddenly the samankal, I was in this room. In this room there were 10 people. The samankal of the Hadassah Hospital shows up. I'm going to show you how important it is to daven and to say tilling. The samankal, the assistant director of Hadassah Hospital, his name is Shapira. He shows up, Shmuel Shapira. He shows up at my bed. So I said, gee, you know, this is what it's like to be a war hero. You know, the samankal comes to visit you. It's all so nice and friendly. I missed the point totally. He comes to my bed. He says, how are you? What's doing? He says, listen, here I am lying in the hospital, feeling sorry for myself, with all these crazy orthopedics patients all around me. And the samankal, the assistant to the director of the Hadassah Hospital, comes and says to me, look, he says, could you do me a favor? So I couldn't believe it. Like, I said, where am I? If he wants me to do him a favor, I said, okay, what can I do for you? He says, you know, we have a delegation of Hadassah women from America coming to the hospital, and they want to see you. Will you see them? So in a stroke of absolute brilliance, I said to him, yes, I'd be happy to see them, but I want an upgrade to business. I am not making this part of the story up. The samankal of Hadassah said, he went like this, and suddenly my bed was moving from the ward to business. And they moved me to business. Business, there were two people in the room, right? There's a room for two people, and they put me over here, and then he comes in, and he says, don't you want a window seat? I said, sure. So I saw that you know, that there are certain moments when power is a very significant commodity. So I was in business for the rest of my stay in Hadassah Hospital. It was very nice. And then the Hadassah women came. It was on Friday morning. It was in the newspaper. It was very interesting. So I was sitting there waiting for the Hadassah women, and the Hadassah women came. I mean, they're not only women, but it was a delegation of Hadassah women. And of course, they didn't want to hear anything about what happened to me. What they wanted to know, each one of them, was whether I knew her niece who had offended Robert. Yeah, I thought about what I was going to say to them, how I'd make the hospital look good, and this, and they said, you know, do you remember so-and-so, you know, and of course, you know, I had to tell them all that I remembered everybody. I mean, it didn't, So in orthopedics, there's a pecking order, which may be the same in all other wards of the hospital, but in orthopedics, it's very pronounced. The pecking order in orthopedics, you know, there's the Gadol Ador. There's the Gadol Ador. The Gadol Ador comes into the ward and never has an interchange with a live patient. Never. He looks at the chart. He talks to the chart. All the other doctors hovering around the Gadol Ador waiting to hear what he's kiddish is about the chart, create a certain atmosphere, a certain aura. It was very hard. It's hard to interrupt, like I was the patient. But it was hard for me to interrupt this ma'amad, you know. So at the end you'd say, excuse me, you know, nothing. You know, they just sort of glide away. You know, this is called Bikur Rofim. But it's not Bikur Cholim. It's just Rofim. That's all. They talk to each other. They don't talk to you. But eventually, this Bikur Rofim filters down to the person who actually does the work, the resident of the ward, right? He's got to actually implement what the Golo Ador has said, you know, that morning. So the resident the one who took care of me, was a young captain, an Israeli. In Israel, you call him Chemed Shel Bachur. Such a nice song, like, you know, it's hard to believe. So you meet a fellow like that, you say, this is also an Israeli. Israelis produce people like this. It's unbelievable. He's nice and kind and quiet and patient and knowledgeable. And I had a lot of confidence in him. So he comes to me. This young doctor, doesn't matter. He comes to me and he says, you know, we were talking to each other about this and that, and he says to me, Shema Harav. He called me, he always called me Harav. And when the nurses called me Chaim, because that's what it says on the chart, right? Just as your name on the chart, he would correct them and he would say Harav, you know, even though he knew nothing about anything Jewish. He had no memories of it. His mother never lit candles Friday night. He doesn't know how to make Kiddush. He didn't know anything. Not a thing. It was remarkable. A wonderful young man. Nothing. No knowledge of Yiddishkeit. But he felt that he wanted to call me Harav. So he comes to me. We're talking. And he says, look, Tishma Harav. He says, I want to ask you something. Ech tzrichim lahodot. Ech tzrichim lahodot. He didn't say that, Kodesh Baruch. He says, Ech tzrichim lahodot. How does one give thanks? That was his question. And I thought, I didn't really know what he meant. I didn't know what he was referring to. So I said to him, Lemata mitkaven. Explain yourself, I said. So he said to me, Mamashal batfila. Ech tzrichim lahodot, when you daven, how do you give hodah? That's what he said. That was his question. And I thought that what he meant was that he wanted me to show him things in the siddur, things in the daily davening that are connected to hodah. So I did that. We said tomorrow morning, such and such time, we'll sit down, we'll start going through the siddur. So I started from Hoda'ah, Nida Fanecha. I showed them that this is Hoda'ah, that other psukim of Hoda'ah. We went through the Hoda'ah. And I saw Rabbi Kimchi's kind words were very kind. But I saw that I was not communicating with him. That whatever he wanted, I was not supplying. I wasn't explaining what he wanted to know. Right? I wasn't explaining. So I said, Tishma, has really opened. Mama Friyach, what is it that's bothering you? What is it that you'd like me to explain to you? So he said to me, he said this to him, he says, Tishma, Achrei Masha Azar Alecha, Ata Becha Aluf Behoda'ah. He said, after what happened to you, you must be a general at Thanksgiving. And of course, I felt terrible. I felt absolutely terrible because I realized that what he saw in me was something that I did not at that moment dare to see in myself. And that shook me up. I mean, more than in a different way, more than what happened to me, this non-religious Israeli doctor saying to me that you must know about Hoda'ah. You must know a lot about it in a manner that he could not even imagine. It just shook me to the bone. But I realized that really he was putting me to shame, and that there was very little at that moment that I could say to him in Turkey. But as a result, I have to say that he and I became friends. And he made me think about what it was that I should have been thinking about, but somehow had overlooked. And that was the problem of Hoda'ah. Everybody knows that we say Birkat HaKohen. Everybody knows that we say it often. Say it often. Even times that seem to us to be almost happy times from beginning to end. Many people say Birkat HaGomer when they take a plane from here to Eretz Yisrael, they come back to England. Birkat HaGomer. You know, you fly in a plane. Today, I think that childbirth is generally a positive, a wondrous experience, not something that is necessarily fraught with danger, and yet the mother says Birkat HaGomer. Today, it's always the mother. I remember there was a time, there were times when after childbirth, women didn't leave the hospital for days and days, and then it was often true that the husband said Birkat HaGomer on behalf of his wife. Today, the women should say Birkat HaGomer in a minyan after leaving the hospital, shortly after they give birth. So that Birkat HaGomer is, as for us, for me, in my life, up to this time, I became sort of a, like a bracha that I'm allowed to say, but I'm not sure that I was able to feel in every case, at every flight, at every plane ride, at every place I went, to feel the profound thanksgiving that is implied in Birkat HaGomer. The bracha, Birkat HaGomer, the bracha of Birkat HaGomer, HaGomer L'Chayavim Tovot. HaGomer L'Chayavim Tovot. A strange bracha. The one who returns good to those who are guilty. To those who are guilty. They say, Monashach. If the Rebbeinu Shlalom has somehow helped us to get through some kind of terrible situation, so wouldn't it be sufficient to say HaGomer Tovot? HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us good. Why do we say Chayavim? Why do we insist on bringing in some kind of difficult aspect to our own thanksgiving? What is it that prevents us from saying that the Rebbeinu Shlalom did good to us? The Bible has a dream to vote. You know that the Medrash says, the Gemara says, that the first one who gave Hoda'ah, the first one who gave Hoda'ah was Leah. Leah, when she had her fourth son. Her fourth son was named Yehuda. Yehuda was named Yehuda because his mother said, Hapam Ode et Hashem. Hapam. Now I can give thanks to HaKadosh Baruch. And Rashi says, Shenatalti Yoter Michelki. Leah said, I now have more than I should have had. Now I have to give thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the Gemara in Brachas, Dav Zayin Amud Beis, Omer Rav Yochanan Mishum Rashbi, B'yom Shebo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Es Olomo Lo, Haya Odom Sheodel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hachebos Leya V'hudaso Shenemar Hapam Odez Hashem. Rav Yochanan says this curious thing. No one ever gave thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu until Leah came along. Did nothing ever happen? Nothing good ever happened to anybody? There was nothing to give thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for? And why did Leah give thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Because she knew that Yaakov had four wives. And she knew that Yaakov would have 12 children. And so she made a little cheshbon. I don't know whether this was like, would get her through the A-level. But she said, 12 children, four wives. I guess each wife should have three children. So when she had a fourth child, when Leah had a fourth child, Yehuda, she said, that thank you, God, is not only about a specific obligation that may have been engendered at a particular time. It's not that Hoda'ah is about, Hoda'ah is not about someone was sick, Rahmanul Salah, and now he's well. Somehow you have this, you go to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say, oh, terrific. I was close, but you got me out of it, Rebbeinu Shlomo. He says, that's not Hodah. Hodah is the Hodah of the Chayyobim. And who are the Chayyobim, those who are guilty? The ones who have to wait till something happens in order to give Hodah. That's the fear that we and I, first amongst them, carry around, the obligation that we have, that we can't look around at what we have and say, we have a lot to be thankful for. We have to wait until there's some sort of an arrangement that we imagine in our minds with the Rebbeinu Shlomo, we say, oh! And that's why Chazal made the bracha, Chayavim, Gomer Lechayavim Tova. What have we been waiting for? And what's happened? And why is that we can't see what is the simplest thing in the world to see that we have so much to be thankful for? Now I want to say something about the situation in Eretz Yisrael. The situation, I feel, the way I understand it, and I don't have any information that you don't have, I don't know anything that you don't know, and I feel nevertheless, my understanding is that we are in a bad situation. It seems to me that normal people, whether they're Irish or Yugoslavian, or Iraqi, normal people, regular people, don't give up what they have. Is that a normal reaction? Is that a normal reaction? You don't have to cover it up with all kinds of theology and munot. It's just not normal. It's not normal. You give away something you have, what? I mean, why should you? Why should anybody give away something they have unless the coercion is tremendous? It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine. So I can imagine that there could be a situation. I don't know what the situation is there, but I can imagine there could be a situation where we would be forced to do things that we don't want to do. What I find difficult to comprehend, I find it impossible to understand how it is possible for people, Jews, who had Jewish parents and Jewish grandparents and came from, whether where they are now doesn't matter, but if they came from the Torah and the mitzvahs and the dreams and the hopes, and that's where they all came from, and have people negotiate giving up Har HaBayit, for example. Can't understand how anybody, any Jew, could do that and not cry. That's something I can't understand. I said, I can't judge the pressures that might be brought to bear on somebody, on a soldier, on a general, on a politician, but a Jew who could think about doing certain things to his whole, to his very essence, his whole being, to cut out your spleen, but not to cry, not to share the tragedy with everybody else. It's because we have lost the ability to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what we have. This whole idea that Eretz Yisrael is a deal, that there's a price. You know, like business. It's like business. That is, you buy out and you buy in, and there is okay, what am I bidding for? Look over there, there's nothing there. Nothing there. So somebody wants to buy it? Well, they're crazy. Crazy people buy territory or land that has nothing on it, no infrastructure, no water, no roads, nothing results in them. Fine. Not fine. Not fine. You close your eyes and you say, Eretz Yisrael. You have to cry. You have to be thankful. You have to have the capacity to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu not only for saving you tomorrow from something that's going to happen that hasn't happened yet, but you have to be able to be thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for everything that you have. You have it. It's Eretz Yisrael. And how many generations of Jews would have given everything to be able to walk in Yerushalayim? I mean, who doesn't have stories like that? Who doesn't know? I mean, it's not that we are coming at judgment on somebody else who's responsible. I don't know, you'll have your judgment and it'll be as good as anybody else's, certainly as good as mine. But how is it possible that our brethren, that brothers, we're brothers, I mean, not all brothers are all putting on tefillin at the same time, or keeping mitzvahs at the same time, but they know that they're brothers. They have the same mother, they have the same grandmother. So we've lost somehow the capacity to think of ourselves as the beneficiaries of a gift. We're chayovim, and we who know are probably the most guilty because we have not been able to communicate this simplest thing to the other people who live with us. And this is so simple. It's so obvious. It's not about anything complicated. It's not a high tech, it's not high business, it's not a shtickle gemara. It's just who we are. And brothers should be able to understand that. So that we are chayyotin because we're not able to give thanks for what we have. And because we're not able to give thanks for what we have, we could talk about deals and not cry. You know, when I was in the hospital, I learned many things. I'll tell you a simple thing that I learned. You know, chesed is a kind of a word that people use. When I was in the hospital, I learned about chesed. And I'm sure that this is true wherever you go, wherever the Jews are. But there were two kinds of chesed practitioners. You know, there are two kinds of chesed. That's all I learned. If people come to you in the hospital, you're on your back, you had an operation, you feel terrible, they come and they look at you and they say, can I help you? People like that. And they mean well. And they would help you. But you're sitting there lying on your back, you feel terrible, you have no kaifas, you just had an operation, you feel bad, you can't move, you can't function, can you help me? No. And another kind of person. There's another kind of person who comes and just helps. They don't ask, what do you need? They just do it. They don't ask, how can I solve your problem? They just do. I was in the hospital in Sylvester, and I couldn't go to Davin. I couldn't go there. I couldn't get into a wheelchair to daven. So I didn't go in the morning. One of these chesed masters of chesed, saw me in the afternoon. I said, where were you? Weren't you sure? This and that. You know, it had nothing to do with me. So I told him I couldn't go. I said, you didn't go. It's a pastor. You didn't have an aliyah. Mincha. I was assured. How he did it, I don't know. I said, I'll tell you that he didn't ask me. It was not negotiated. I was assured. I got an aliyah. And because I couldn't get out of my wheelchair, so I had to lean. Like they leaned, they wanted to make sure I could see the laning, so he got three guys to hold the Sefer Torah up while they leaned. And then so all this, I didn't say a word. I didn't say a word. So I learned that there are masters of chesed, and it has an effect. And there are also masters of hodor, of thanksgiving. And that's what my doctor was asking me about. And if we were the masters of thanksgiving that we should be, if we were able to communicate to everybody that we see, that we know, how thankful we are that we live in that special time when Eretz Yisrael is ours, when we can walk where we wish to walk, where we can daven at the Kotel Maravi. Imagine davening at the Kotel Maravi. I came to Eretz Yisrael in 1965. We used to go to Abu Tur. I mean, everybody went to Abu Tur. Abu Tur, there was a fence. The border was at Abu Tur. If you stood on your tiptoes in Abu Tur, you could see the top of the Dome of the Rock, whatever it's called, right? Harim al-Sharif. You could see the top, the golden dome. And we would say to ourselves, that's Har HaBayit. That's Har HaBayit. You're standing by a fence. We stand by a fence and we shake the fence. And then the Jordanian police would come over and give us cigarettes. You want a cigarette? Because the Jordanian police, I'll tell you all the world we live in. The Jordanian police had American cigarettes. You understand? You know what American cigarettes are? No? American cigarettes in those days were the sign. They had them and we didn't. You understand? It was a statement. They didn't shoot us. They gave us Marlboros. Here's a Marlboro. And we could go to them and say, here, you want a time? You want a time? They would say, time? Like we, Marlboros. But this was like a reality. You know, everybody knew it. The Jordanian police, down to their toes, they had the Marlboros. And we stood on our tiptoes and looked at the Har HaBayit, took a picture, and then we take it home and put it on the wall. Like, it was like, it's not only a Zecher LaMikdash, it was a Zecher to being able to see the Mikdash. And here we are, not so many years later, well, Hashem, you were all, many of you were here then. I'm still here, 1965, till today. What? And all we did was, we have it, we can go to daven, we go to daven mincha. I can get up in my house today, any time of the day and night, and say, Bo Mikvot Lakotel, imagine that. You tell the Ramban, Bo Mikvot Lakotel. Yeah, we can do it. You go and tell Rav Yehuda Levi. Because Sakoto, the Ashbod, the Balei Tosfot, say it's nothing. It's not a dream. It's actually nothing. Now that outside my house is a bus, number two bus, right to the Kotel. Right to the Kotel. You know that the number two bus, Moses Shabbos, you go to Daven Ma'ariv, the first bus is free. Free, because no one has money. No one has a KTCA, you can't go to the bus. Imagine this. Imagine the world that we're living in. You can, if you stop to think about it. But we don't stop to think about it enough. And that's what Hodor is. Hodor is not about what I got this minute, what has affected me in the last 2 months. Hodor is the big picture. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing, and we are chayovim. We are chayovim because we have not been able to sensitize ourselves to the glory of our own situation. And we're doubly chayav because when the doctor comes to ask me, what does it mean to have hodor, I'm dumbfounded by the question. And we have not been able, to make this simple message heard. Simple. Everybody could understand it. So I had to talk with my doctor. And he understood it a little bit better. And I understood it a lot better. And I wish you all that we should all be healthy and wise and should not have to undergo bad situations. And if we do have to undergo bad situations, that we should be saved from them by the Rachman of the Rebbeinu Shalom. And that we should understand that Thanksgiving is an avoda. To be able to be thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not something that we have to wait about. It's something that we have to do. It's our obligation, and it's the only hope that we'll be able to straighten ourselves out to some extent in the terrible situation which we find ourselves in Eretz Yisrael. Thank you. Kol Tov.